On Sunday, December 10th at 11 p.m., Suga and My Bowl kicks off our Winter Jazz Festival coverage with saxophonist, bandleader, and composer Shibaka Hutchings. Join us as we discuss some of Shibaka's projects, including Sons of Kemet and The Comet is Coming, which will be featured at the festival. That's Sunday, December 10th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Suga and My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. We're kicking off our Winter Jazz Festival preview programming with saxophonist, clarinetist, and composer Shibaka Hutchings, two of Shibaka's groups, Sons of Kemet. And The Comet is Coming will be featured during the festival. We're also in fundraising mode, so we need you to give your financial support by calling 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Suga and My Bowl, starting now.
Save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Shabaka Hutchings.
Shabaka Hutchings, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm calling you... Well, I'm in New York, you're in the UK. This is where you grew up? You were born in Barbados?
I was actually born in the UK, but then I moved over to Barbados when I was six and lived there for the next 10 years.
What did that do for you musically?
I think many things. I mean, just one, being exposed to Caribbean culture, not from the perspective of diaspora, but actually, you know, being there, like seeing what the relationship of the island is to its music, seeing like what it is to actually experience carnival in a place where it originated. It was interesting experiencing carnival back in England and seeing that it is a different perspective when the whole thing is a spectacle. And there's the whole idea of people performing carnival and then onlookers is something that's quite a diasporic thing, whereas in the Caribbean it's more, the whole thing is participatory. You know, that's one of the broad things that I got from living in the Caribbean. The other things, such as, I think one of the aspects of my diversity musically comes from the fact that there wasn't that much focus on genre or focus on what musicians couldn't be. So a musician might be studying classically and still playing calypso bands, still playing reggae bands, or still playing jazz. There's less of focus if you are defined as one musical being, that's what you have to do.
How did you wind up playing saxophone? And first off, is that tenor saxophone that you're playing?
Yeah. I started on clarinet, actually. And I would say that the clarinet is my kind of first main instrument. That's what I studied. I did a classical degree on the clarinet, and that's kind of what I feel most comfortable on. But the bands that I present or have been working in for the last few years, I only play sax in it. And I started off with the clarinet. It's an interesting transformation from the clarinet to the saxophone, which I guess I could discuss.
How so?
I started in Barbados on the clarinet just because at school they were like, who wants to play an instrument? And I said, I'll have a go at it. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the feeling of being by myself and working on things. And I enjoyed being able to interact with people through music. So I think that's what kept me going and kept me interested in it. And it wasn't a big external pressure to be a musician. There wasn't any pressure at home to play an instrument or anything. Although my mother was very supportive, once I did get into something that I could really, you know, excel in.
There are no other musicians in the household, huh?
No.
Okay. You started with bass clarinet then, yes?
No, just the small, the regular clarinet.
Oh, okay. But you recorded with bass clarinet.
Yeah, I've done most of the recording I have done on clarinet. I've been on bass clarinet just because I really like the sound of it.
Oh, okay.
And I feel like the clarinet I started with, if there's a piece that I've composed, I might write the clarinet in for myself. So I've written pieces for string quartets or for brass ensemble, all with me on clarinet with those groups. But for the bands that I have an ongoing relationship with, or I'm playing clubs, and the bands are the things that I think represent, you know, what's happening in London at the moment and my positionality to that. The sax is what my main voice is.
Is there a difference between communicating on a, for my lack of term, regular clarinet over a bass clarinet? Is there a difference for you in playing?
Yeah, it's a personality thing, you know, and this is, you know, something that it extends to the difference between playing the saxophone and the clarinet. They both represent different mediums for expression. You know, when I play the bass clarinet, it's a different voice, you know, and that voice has a different story to tell. And what I play is as much a reflection of the medium and the space that I'm playing and the context of the music as it is what I personally need to get out. So, you know, and it's one of the things that I'm really aware of in general, trying to have what I play be influenced by all of these factors as opposed to me going, you know, I have a personal vision of what music should be and I'm going to kind of give it irrespective of the circumstances that surround the process of making music. So, yeah, I'm trying to be influenced by those things. So I'm trying to see what the bass clarinet has to tell me, in a way, or what the space is that I play.
I guess also I was wondering technically, as a musician fingering different instruments, is there a marked difference between your playing clarinet and bass?
Yeah, I guess the way that you blow it is different. Yeah, because obviously there's more wood for the air to go through. So, it's a different relationship between your body and the air. So, physically, it's a different sensation. In terms of the fingering, you know, nothing that a couple of days back is on kind of do for you.
Okay, great. So now that you've decided what tools you'll be using musically, now I understand composition is really important. Did you study that where you studied clarinet?
No, I took a few composition classes, but the piece is really bad. I really didn't enjoy it. It was more along the lines of conceptual classical composition. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I didn't want to know about that. And actually, now I still don't want to know about it.
Okay.
just because, you know, for me, it's someone's concept, and I wasn't kind of knocking their concept, but it had nothing to do with what I wanted to present. So I read a lot of the, you know, Stockhausen, what he has to say, or like on Cage. I appreciate it from their perspective, but it's not anything that resonates with my vision of music.
Mm-hmm.
So I dropped out of the class and just kind of did it by myself. And I found that the exciting part, having to actually, from that point of view, find my way compositionally. Like, what are the tools that I need to compose? And if I don't like an area of the classical canon that presents a certain vision of composition, how am I going to, you know, like, what do I want to draw from? And that's come from studying, you know, jazz composition, then studying lots of other areas of classical composition. So, you know, I'm interested in a lot of Bartok or some elements of Stravinsky, people like Ave Part I'm really interested in. And then studying a lot of African music, especially Central African polyphonic music. I've seen, like, what areas of those musical compositional processes resonate with me. The main thing, I guess, with the compositional process with myself is trying to not find things that are complicated. Like, really see what is it that kind of kicks off something in my head that goes, I think that this is what can add to my vision, you know, if I have a vision at all, you know.
have seemed to created three visions that I'm aware of have been introduced to this country in the form of Sons of Kemet, which apparently is your main group. And
yeah.
Last year I was introduced to Shabaka and the Ancestors, which was another voice that you have, one of the other projects. And for the 2018 Winter Jazz Festival, you're bringing The Comet Is Coming. Could you explain or describe the genesis of those projects and what sound you're trying to communicate through them?
Okay. So Sons of Kemet is the oldest project of those three. And it was really the first time I tried to present a London band from the point where I was living in London. Before that, I'd played in a lot of people's ensembles. I was playing a lot of music that wasn't my own. I'm playing a lot of free and flies music, which I really enjoyed, but I felt like there wasn't an outlet for a vision of music that I thought really represented all the aspects of what I've grown up listening to, what I'll be humming if I'm walking down the street, and everything that I've learned. So and a lot of that is coming from an Afro-Caribbean background. So it's saying, I really want to play improvised music. I want to play music that might be described as avant-garde, but I still want to be able to send something back home to my boys in Barbados and have them go, yeah, I like this.
Right.
And the Sons of Kemet was an attempt to try to like merge that. Like the thing of if you're on a school dinner table and all your friends are just kind of like beeping some rhythms on the table and you're, and everyone's around in a kind of circle and you're making music and you're enjoying it. It's just rhythms and someone's like singing a melody. It's trying to get that atmosphere, but being able to also introduce all the stuff that I've also learned in terms of my relationship to the tradition of jazz, American jazz, the tradition of free improvised music. I'm trying to see if there's a way where all of these things have a space. And some of them, you know, have a space at certain elements of the band's existence more than others. But that was the kind of my main thought when I started writing the music and trying to get the concept for Sons of Kemet.
On the subject of Sons of Kemet, you have two drummers, Tom Skinner and Sebastian Rockford. Am I pronouncing that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Seb doesn't play with us anymore.
Oh, okay.
But we've got a new drummer called Eddie Hick, who is... it's really amazing.
Okay. What was the decision on having two drummers?
It was a couple of things, actually. One was simply I wanted the two personalities. At the beginning, it was Seb and Tom. And I just wanted to see what happened when they played together. I didn't want to choose one or the other. Also, I found that whenever two drums play together, it's less an emphasis on one individual fulfilling a rhythmic purpose. It's not that one person holds down the rhythm and interacts with the soloist occasionally when you hear something that he likes. You know, as soon as there's two individuals in front of a whole drum kit, then it's more about communication. It's more about an actual dialogue between them, and that dialogue creates the rhythm, as opposed to them going, okay, this is what I see as rhythm because of what I've encountered before. It also just harks back to a more kind of fundamental people playing the drums, something that I thought about a lot in the context of my bands. You know, how can we get to a position where we're not playing jazz, we're not playing groove or funk or Caribbean music. We are just individuals doing things, you know. It doesn't start off like that, but there's always a point in the set where it reaches this frenzy where it just becomes two people hitting the drum. And that's what I'm interested in. And that's something that can only come, I think, from having two drummers.
Okay.
You know.
You have a tuba voice. Now, I'm not sure who's speaking that these days. Thean Cross has been on here, and Orin Marshall. Who's presently your tuba voice?
Yeah, Thean Cross is the one,
Okay. And what was the impetus for including a tuba voice?
Well, one, just the duplicity of the role they can inhabit, you know. The thing with the tuba is that it can be a bass instrument.
Right.
It can be a melodic horn. I like that interchangeability of the roles. That's what I really, really like. I mean, I guess it's the same as the drum, of being able to have a conversation and being able to, just if they want, be a rhythmic propeller.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have that feeling of, what is that? You know, is it a bass or is it another horn playing? Yeah, something that, you know, that connects it to the New Orleans tradition as well, I really like.
Nice. The next project, I guess, would be Chewbacca and the Ancestors.
Yeah. This project came about through many years of going back and forwards between London and South Africa. My ex-girlfriend was South African, so I was in a long-distance relationship and just going, maybe spending 2 to 3 months twice a year. And I'd not be there with any big plans musically. So I'd be going to jam sessions, singing with other people's gigs, and just really trying to see what the scene was saying. And it's been a legacy of jazz in South Africa for a long time, the 40s. So they've got their legends and they've got their elder musicians and then musicians that go back even before, you know, things that not necessarily coming out of the jazz tradition, but do inform how people view jazz. So it's very interesting just seeing this whole, like, alternate vision of jazz or alternate way of perceiving, you know, what jazz can be from a South African perspective. So about a year ago, a bit more than a year ago, I decided to record the album that we have, Wisdom of Elders. And initially, it was just supposed to be a statement. It was just supposed to, this is what happens when the experiences that I've had in South Africa so far, this is a document of them. I wasn't trying to make a band or really kind of form a unit. It was just the players that have had good experiences that have taught me stuff and that I think I've loved off on in some ways. We recorded the album and it did a lot better than I think any of us thought it would have done, because we managed to tour around a lot in South Africa, but we also managed to tour around Europe in 3 tour periods this year. So the band has really progressed, you know, become a unit.
And that particular band opened for Pharoah Sanders during the Winter Jazz Festival earlier in 2017. What was that like for you, just being able to open for Pharoah Sanders?
It's pretty surreal. It's nothing that I could have imagined, you know. It's an interesting thing, I guess, having a relationship with jazz music from afar. So you hear the names of these legends and you see their connection to your heroes, and you see that they are your heroes, and then all of a sudden there's a man in front of you. And I think there's something that makes the whole journey more real when you can see an actual musician, hear him like in the flesh, and see that he is a person that has practiced to get to where he has gotten, and he's gone through actual experiences that aren't just words on a paper or statements in an interview. You know, it's inspiring just in that to see that, you know, there's a real process that these guys go through. And the process is something that, like, I'm going through, that the other guys on the stage in the band are going through, that everyone's going through in their own way, considering the social context that we're coming from.
The vocalist that you have in Chewbacca and the Ancestors, could you pronounce his name, please?
Yeah. Siyabonga Mpendu.
He was amazing. He's fantastic. That energy that he brings to the music was just incredible. He is indeed another instrument, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
What is your relationship with him, and how did he wind up in the group?
He has a band of his own in Johannesburg called The Brotherhood Zone. And I became a massive fan of them. They're an incredible band. I couldn't tell you what genre they played in, because it's one of these bands that just has elements of so many things. So it's got elements of jazz, fusion, it's got elements of traditional South African music, elements of rock. Just, yeah, everything is just in there. It's just the individuals make the music.
Amanda Comrade. Amanda Comrade. Economic freedom in our time.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Shugan Mabo's the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. What you're listening to in the background is Dagawe. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. This is from The Brother Moves On and their release, The Golden Wake. It's self-released and is available via Bandcamp.com. This is a 2015 release, and it features Siyabonga Ntembu, a.k.a. Mr. Gold, as the storyteller, lead vocalist, and performance artist. You can find out more about the members on sugarandmybowl.org when you check the playlist, or you can find us on Facebook where we post the playlist there as well. Before that, we heard Imzwandele. I hope I pronounced that correctly too. I wish I spoke Tosa. This is from Shabaka and the Ancestors. Wisdom of the Elders was the name of the release, a 2016 Brownswood Records release. This is Giles Peterson's label, and Shabaka Hutchings will be at the Winter Jazz Festival with his groups Sons of Kemet and The Comet Is Coming. Shabaka Hutchings on tenor saxophone on this recording, and many other artists whose names I do not want to mistake, but you can find out by going to the playlist at sugarandmybowl.org or checking our Facebook event page. Before that, we heard Beware from Sons of Kemet and their release Burn. This is a 2013 Naim Jazz release. Shabaka Hutchins on tenor saxophone, clarinet, and he's also the composer. Orrin Marshall on tuba, Tom Skinner on drums, Seb Rockford on drums as well, and featured artist Dave Okumu on guitar. Before that, we heard Inner Babylon, also from the 2013 Naim Jazz Burn release. Before that, we heard Start Running from The Comet Is Coming. Death to the Planet is the name of that EP. This is a 2017 release, available through Bandcamp.com. Shabaka Hutchings, a.k.a. King Shabaka, on tenor saxophone, and he's also a co-composer. Maxwell Hallett, a.k.a. Beta Max Killer, on drums. And Dan Levers, a.k.a. Danalog the Conqueror, on keyboards. And before that, of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. Nina Simone, the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. Originally recorded in 1967, this is a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Don't forget to call us to show your financial support at 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Sugar in My Bowl and more with Shabaka Hutchings continues.
Invited, and the venue was quite a big dry venue, and it wasn't really, you know, like interesting people in the audience. I was just passing them on the street randomly, and I saw them standing there looking sad after this gig, and I said, remember me from Cape Town? And they're like, yeah, how's it going? And I said, you know, you should come down to this place that I'm playing tomorrow. I'm actually playing with The Comet Is Coming in this warehouse called the Tulsa Chrysler Center. And they're like, yeah, great, we've got our instruments. And, you know, I phoned up the guy who was organizing the night, and he said, you know, they can play after you if you want. So they came down and played an incredible set in a warehouse, a legal warehouse party. And then that's how the relationship started, where whenever they were touring in Europe, I'd kind of guest with them. And then when I was in South Africa, we'd keep the relationship going, and there was a real kind of back and forth interchange. When I started in The Ancestors, I thought I really wanted to see his energy. But the thing that he gives to that group is a sense of, I don't know, it's like you've got the ability to realize the energy potential and just max and just like push it. Mm-hmm. You know, so like whatever anyone, like obviously when he sings, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. But it feels like his singing is a way of him actually solidifying the energy that's going on around him in the band. Mm-hmm. And really pushing it forward.
On the names of the two groups, Sons of Kemet and Shabaka and the Ancestors, was that your decision, yeah, both names?
Yeah, ultimately, the Sons of Kemet was my decision. The word Shabaka and the Ancestors actually came from the alto saxophone player in the group, Mkinzi Mrubu. He came up with the name, and as soon as he said it, I was like, that's it. You know, all of these ideas of the significance of that combination of words, you know, it kind of flooded into me, and it made a lot of sense in terms of the stuff that I've been thinking about to do with my positionality towards ancestry, you know, mm-hmm. coming from the Caribbean, and how it resonates with me playing with South African. Sunday Kemet came about from me being, at the time of starting the band, very interested in what is the legacy of Kemeticism, what is the legacy of Egypt, and also because my name, Shabaka, I'm named after the last Nubian king of Egypt, of a Nubian pharaoh of Egypt, united the Upper Lower Egypt. And he actually commissioned a Shabaka stone to be written on, and that's what solidified or captured all the philosophical teachings of the time, which the later studies in part would form like the basis of Kemeticism. Yeah, I think the word Kemeticism is a relatively new way of seeing what was going on in the upper echelons of the society at the time. It wasn't called Kemeticism at the time that it was practiced.
Right.
Kemet literally means the land of Egypt,
right,
or the black land.
Right. Do you study a lot of Kemetic and, you know...
A bit. Like, at the time, I was reading a lot more. So I was really into the Metroneta.
Uh-huh.
I was into a book called Black Athena, which is looking at the way that Greek philosophy is being influenced by teachings of Egypt.
That's Martin Bernal, right?
I wouldn't say that I'm a scholar.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? I am interested in it. I'm interested
sure.
in how I can learn from it.
Well, I take it, based on what you produce, the information lends itself to your compositions?
Yeah, in a roundabout way.
Mm.
I've got a strange relationship to composing, in that I don't really compose for things. I wouldn't read a lot about Kemeticism and then say, I'm going to write a piece about this aspect of Kemeticism. For me, it's about immersing yourself in a certain aspect of history or a certain informational process, and then writing, seeing what comes out. I feel like the period of time that you're in affects how you compose and what you teach to compose. So if at that period of time I'm into the teachings of Kemet, then everything that I write in some ways will be inspired by that way of thinking.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for December 10th. This segment features aerial listings of Shug and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's show features saxophonist Shabaka Hutchings. You can catch him in January at the Winter Jazz Fest. He'll be at Les Poissons Rouges on the 10th with The Comet Is Coming, and he'll also be leading Sons of Kemet on either the 12th or 13th. The exact date and time is to be announced. Keep listening, and we'll let you know when the schedule is finalized. And we have lots more listings for you this week. We start with Emma Franz's documentary film, Bill Frisell, A Portrait. That's showing at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village through December 14th. Vocalist Catherine Russell is at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Rose Theater from December 13th through 17th with Big Band Holidays. Saxophonist Gary Bartz and drummer Lenny White are at Smoke for a John Coltrane tribute from the 14th through the 17th. Drummer Francisco Moore-Catlett leads Afrohorn with trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah, and that's at the Lower East Side's Clemente Soto Velez Center on the 16th. That's all part of Vision Fest promoters Arts for Arts month-long Justice's Compassion Festival. Trombonist Craig Harris is at New Blue in the East Village on the 16th, and that's part of the New Blue Jazz Fest. The Sun Ra Orchestra, led by Marshall Allen, makes an earthly return at New Blue, and that's on the 16th to close out the New Blue Jazz Fest. Looking a little further ahead, pianist Harold Mayburn leads a quartet at Smoke from December 18th all the way through January 6th. Bassist William Parker and dancer Patricia Nicholson Parker are at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem on the 19th, and they'll be doing a talk and performance about jazz and social justice. Vibraphonist Roy Ayers is at the Iridium on December 26th and 27th. Finally, vocalist Renee Marie is at the Jazz Standard from December 28th through the 31st. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. Please think about WBAI during the holiday season and give the gift of non-commercial listener-supported radio. By pledging whatever you can, you'll help the station stay on the air, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The Support WBAI link on our website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our bi-weekly schedule, we're off the air next week. but we'll have updated event listings online and are scheduled to be back on air on December 24th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
WBAI has begun to engage new and creative off-air fundraising methods. A concerned WBAI supporter has generously donated his Manhattan home for a WBAI fundraising party on Wednesday, December 13th. The event includes Professor Richard Wolf, a tribute to David Rothenberg, and various other WBAI producers. Also attending are General Manager Bertold Reimers, Programming Manager Tony Bates, and a special guest from the Resistance. It all takes place in Manhattan on Wednesday, December 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. Entry to the party, which includes food and drinks, is only a $500 donation to WBAI. Donations from the event will be dedicated to WBAI's Empire State Building Fund. Registration ends on Tuesday, December 12th at 5 p.m. Space is very limited, so RSVP now by calling AMA at 347-886-2026 or by emailing ama@wbai.org.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
There was one composition that you wrote. Actually, this is going back to a Sons of Kemet release.
Yeah.
Lest we forget what we came here to do, which I think that title is fabulous. I love that. There was a selection you had in memory of Samir Awad. And I've heard you bring that up in response to issues of social justice. You present that piece as an example of your work. Could you tell us a bit about that?
So Samir Awad, the case of Samir Awad is something that stuck with me in terms of who we decide to commemorate. And in a place like England where you see a lot of monuments, and I guess the same resonates in America with the whole looking at statues and what you're actually supposed to be commemorating and what's actually behind the commemoration of certain figures. So I've always remembered this case of Samir being a young teenager who was protesting the building of a wall that went through his village in the Gaza. And it's really sort of shot him in the back. And it's been protested through Amnesty International. And there has been a lot of attention at the time as to why his case, among many others, was a completely unjustified killing. And a killing that in some ways meant nothing. It wasn't investigated fully. And it was just another brown person who died within an area that seemed to be a war zone. So the regular rules of law isn't supposed to apply. I'm seeing this case and I'm thinking, he's a son of a person, of a mother. Just because of his skin color, where he happened to be born, his life, it doesn't mean any less than someone else's. But there's going to be no commemoration. There's going to be no monument or plaques or necessarily songs dedicated to his life. So in some ways, the naming of this tune isn't specifically for Samir Awad. It's for the Samir Awads, the lives that are lost without any mention.
And Samir Awad is a Palestinian?
Yeah, he's a Palestinian teenager.
That could be applied to many of these situations that are happening all over the world, especially in this country.
Oh, yeah.
In hearing that you present that piece as an example of the social justice issues that you raise in your work, do you also consider the subject of immigration an issue under the banner of social justice?
I guess so, because it is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, in reading about In the Castle of My Skin, that sounds like you're talking about immigration or coming of age as an immigrant.
Yeah, in some ways about that. So the title In the Castle of My Skin is taken from a George Lamming book. And
right.
George Lamming is a Barbadian author. And the book is mirroring the progression of Barbados from a colonial state to independence.
Right.
The coming of age of a young boy within that time, progressing from boyhood to manhood, progression of a country from a colonial state to a kind of autonomous independent state. I guess, yeah, it's like when you're looking at the concept of state and like what we see as the state, like the state is the borders that surround it. When we say the country of America, we're just talking about the processes of exclusion that says you can't come over here, you know. So, I mean, that's actually what we're trying to look at. You know, who decides what a country is? Who decides other people can't come in? And what's the point of it? That decision is taken. What are the other factors, the other forces, the impetus behind those decisions?
Mm-hmm. I seem to be really putting this particular release, Lest We Forget What We Came Here to Do, under a magnifying glass, because there's something else you have on here. There's an ode to Octavia E. Butler. Thank you. and you straight up have another selection called Afrofuturism. Where did that come into play?
So I'm a massive Octavia Butler fan, and actually I came into contact with her work because my father gave my mother an Octavia Butler book.
Which
when we were going out years ago, The Parable of the Talents. And she gave me it. And I didn't read it for many years. I was like, Parable, and whatever. Like keeping sometimes with your parents. Mm-hmm. So I didn't read it. And then when I finally did read it, I was bowled over.
Yeah.
You know, it was exactly what I needed at that time in terms of thinking of ways of looking at religion, ways of looking at our relationship to the earth and like, what skills we have and what skills we choose to learn and how we choose to see ourselves, our position, our kind of surroundings. So I decided to name the tune after the feeling that the book inspired in me, as opposed to writing it for Octavia directly. Like I found when I read her books, so other things like Bloodline, Fledgling, there's a certain atmosphere that surrounds my feeling of reality after, like slightly after having read the book. So I'm writing a tune in response to that feeling that she's using it.
We'll be right back.
Afrofuturism, in some ways I was writing that because I was thinking a lot about the term Afrofuturism at the time. I saw a lecture with Quadro Essam, who is an art theorist from the UK, and he was discussing lots of things to do with Afrofuturism, which he brought up Octavia Butler, who's going over possible definitions and ways of seeing it. And something that he said really struck with me. He called Afrofuturism a poetization of the past or past genres. And I was thinking about that term for days and weeks after it. And I thought, yeah, I like it. And for me, if I were to say, what is Afrofuturism? I'd say it's giving yourself or a group of African or African diasporic people the ability to actually direct how we see the legacy of Africa, how we see the images that signify the legacy of Africa, and like where we keep the place those signifiers. And that's what I think he means by the poeticization of it, because it's not necessarily things that need to be taken literally. It's how do we take all the issues surrounding Africa and Africanness and blackness and historical blackness, and how do we take those things and actually place them in ways that assume that we have agency. Because a lot of issues to do with blackness or Africanness have been dictated by historical struggle.
Right.
So our thinking towards it, it kind of moves with the tide of either oppression or resistance to oppression.
Right.
So for me, I really like the idea of saying, okay, we have the agency to start viewing, trying to view blackness or Africanness with an eye to the poetic. Something that comes not through the opposition to struggle. And it's not saying that the opposition to struggle isn't there.
It is.
You know, and it's not saying that the struggle, that struggle is definitely there.
Right.
But it's saying that we have the agency to also try to find other ways of defining blackness that can run concurrent to the ways that are handed to us. When you see things like, I guess, the regular tropes of Afrofuturism, the things that you see in pop culture, like black people in space or kind of this funky imagery on black things. For me, it's the idea of someone, a black person, taking the agency in providing an image that is not normally associated with black or blackness. And that's part of a myriad of things. Yeah, that's what I call the piece of Afrofuturism.
Got it.
We'll be right back.
The comet is coming. Yes.
Yeah.
Tell us about that group.
This group, in some way, was similar to Serakian Ancestors in that it wasn't started as an attempt to be a group. The two other members in the group, Dan and Max, were a unit of their own. They were a duo called Soccer 96, synthesizer and drums. And I was a massive fan of them. I used to go to a lot of their concerts around London, and just the energy that they played with, I was bowled over with, and I just wanted to hear it again and again. So I started to bring my sax for their gigs and ask if I could sit in. And every time they'd say yes, and it would be really good to experience. Eventually we said, we need to get into the studio and just do something. So we got to the studio for like 4 days, and we just hit record and just recorded.
Wow.
We just played from like the morning to the night, every day for 4 days. Dan is a really amazing producer. So he spent months and months cutting out the good bits and producing it into an album. So we took the tunes that we improvised and then carved a live set from that and then started gigging, mainly in like kind of warehouse parties and unofficial venues around East London. And then the band was born.
Could you name the members of the band?
So we've got Danalog on the synthesizer and we've got Betamax on drums.
Okay. And both The Comet Is Coming and Sons of Kemet are coming to the Winter Jazz Festival.
Yeah.
So I guess Bryce Rosenbloom likes you.
I think so, yeah. I hope so, or else there's something really strange going on if he doesn't like it.
How did you get the invitation? What was the invitation like?
Well, The Comet Is Coming is being presented through a kind of British jazz showcase through the British PRS and something else in British underground. I don't know, I probably should know this happening. They'll probably give me lots of flack for not knowing exactly. Paying us to go there. But basically, there is a really jazz showcase with other people that are really doing stuff in the scene at the moment. So Nibaya Garcia is coming with us. Yaz Ahmed is coming off the drum. So I think we got invited as a part of that.
Okay.
Sons of Kemet is coming because we just got invited.
Yes.
And we have a new album that's going to be released, I think, at the beginning of March.
Okay. I need to thank you for presenting. I mean, you are definitely your own PR, although you are not. You are a walking PR for your projects. When I met you backstage with Pharoah Sanders, you gave me 3 CDs. You gave me 2 Sons of Kemet and Shabak and the Ancestors. Is that what you ordinarily do all the time?
You know, it's like I'll have things to give to people because it's like no one's buying CDs anyway.
Right.
So in some ways it's just like, if you got an album, just give it to people who might be able to share it.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense being like, oh, everyone's got to buy my album all the time because the aim is to get people to listen to the album. For instance, in a case like backstage in a show, then I might meet someone if there's a vibe and I think, you know, okay, this person seems like a good person. Mm-hmm. I'll give them my CD.
And most people tend to call CD production these days as a calling card, which is exactly how you use it. Does it matter to you about being on a label? Is that of importance?
It's just what the individual musician wants and what wants from that label. In some ways, it doesn't matter. Like, you can go at it solo. But for me, I don't have the time to go at it solo because I'm touring.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't want to be stuck in front of my computer doing the administrative process that's involved in forming your own label. And it needs a process or else no one's going to hear it. You know, I've seen a lot of people start their own labels, but they don't have the time to actually do the legwork that's needed to really have it function properly. So in my case, a label is needed. Also, like, for instance, we put out Tobacco and the Ancestors on Dal Peterson's Roundtrip label.
Exactly.
And that was useful in terms of the contextualization of it, because obviously they have a big following.
Right.
A lot of it is jazz-based, a lot of it isn't jazz-based. So you actually put an album out with him meant that it was opening up to an audience that maybe wouldn't have gone towards our music initially. So like these days, you just got to be savvy. You know, you can't just assume that you put out a record of, you know, what you think is good music and people are going to listen to it because of the music alone. That's not the world we live in. It's got to have context. You know, it's got to go towards people. And for me, a part of artists deciding how you place your music with integrity. Because if you don't place it, someone else is going to place it.
True.
And they might not have integrity.
Right.
You know what I mean? So,
in 2015, apparently you received a commission from the London Sinfonietta. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah, Sinfonietta.
To write a note to the new government. What was that?
Yeah, so it was just before
the election, and actually the piece was premiered the day after the election. And this is the election that got in the current Tory government. And they wanted artists to actually find an aspect of the political landscape that liberated them and write a piece in response to it. I decided to write a piece on political apathy because people in this country do not vote.
Right.
And this has been one of the interesting things in the wave of Jeremy Corbyn, is that all of a sudden a massive part of the population who were not voting all of a sudden decided is someone that we can vote for, which the political elite didn't like very much. Very similar to Bernie Sanders in a way.
Right.
For Jeremy Corbyn, people didn't like, it's something like 80,000 people were not even registered to vote.
Wow.
No one I knew was voting. You know, black people didn't vote, poor white people didn't vote, no one voted. Because, like, why would you want to vote? There's nothing to vote for.
Do you have that
piece?
You know,
it's like, I have it written. I wasn't that happy with actually how the recording came out. And it's an ongoing problem I've got with working with classical ensemble, especially like that. There's a limited time to rehearse, and it's like they assume that the piece is going to be easy for them. And if it's not easy for them to just get in 1-2 hour rehearsal and then gig, they just perform it badly and then move on.
Oh, no.
So, yeah.
Okay.
It's in my drawer, and at some point we'll have the, you know, the funds to rehearse it properly and record it, and then that'll be fun.
Oh, okay. Gosh.
I'm really happy with the piece.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to hear it someday.
Yeah, it's like, it's time after time. I wrote a piece for the BBC Concert Orchestra that was performed. It was actually the BBC Concert Orchestra and Tonsi Kemet and two electronic musicians called Babylon. Yeah, they just messed it up.
I'm sorry, they messed it up?
Yeah. because they just weren't interested in putting in work into a piece from someone who they didn't respect at that time.
Right.
And this
was
maybe like 4 years ago.
It's actually kind of interesting, the fact that the call is placed to and the request is made for you to put in the work to do it, but they don't put in the work to play it properly.
Yeah, but it's coming from two different places. The people that decide, for whatever reason, you need a jazz person to present a thing. It's not even from the same reality of the orchestra musician who thinks, I want to be playing Shostakovich this symphony.
Right.
More than I want to be playing with. I even had a thing where the clarinetist in that piece came up to me after one of the rehearsals and says, can you play this? And I was like, yeah, I can play it. I'm a clarinetist.
Right.
You know? And he's like, go on then. And I was like, I'm not going to, because that's your job.
Oh my
gosh.
Like,
you know, oh, I guess I'll have to practice then. You know?
Oh my gosh.
And the,
yeah,
and
I guess you
came
do.
Up to me. Yeah. The conductor came up to me after the concert and he apologized.
Good.
You know, and he said, really sorry, but there are some players who they have a contract and they can't be fired, and they were good maybe 20 years ago and now they're just not very good.
Wow. Actually, on that subject, though, even in quote-unquote jazz, there is a thinking that there are older players who don't care for what newer players are doing. Have you encountered that tension?
Not in an aggressive way, because I think maybe the temperament of Americans is different to British people. So just from what I've seen, I get the impression that in America, maybe older players let it be known that they disapprove of what younger players are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think in England, when there's disapproval, there's apathy. They just will ignore you.
Oh, God. Okay.
You know, I mean, it's just like they'll just pretend that you're not doing it.
I see.
In general, it's just, I've had support from older musicians.
Okay.
You know.
I noticed two older musicians in particular that you really received love from. They asked you to play with them. The Sun Ra Orchestra, Marshall Allen, the Sun Ra Orchestra. And, you know, I have a hard time remembering how to pronounce his name, but Mutla Astake?
Oh, Mulatu.
Mulatu.
Yeah, Mulatu Astake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did that feel like? How was that for you, being invited to play with them?
That was great. Yeah. Big T Ben, at the time that I was invited, I didn't know a lot of his work. So the project with Malachi was a collaboration between the Heliocentrics.
Heliocentrics, okay.
Which is a London-based group. They made an album with Malachi that I was a part of. And then we started touring, so we toured for about 2 years. And throughout that 2 years, it's like getting to know his music, getting to know actually the significance of it, and actually how he's brought in a lot of Ethiopian traditions to the music. And I actually went to Ethiopia a few months ago. I met him over there and was able to play in his club. And, you know, he's an amazing, amazing guy. I'm very supportive.
And how about the orchestra?
Yeah, there's a lot you can say about that relationship.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, so we start the kind of beginnings where they had to do a session for the BBC, so the BBC suggested that I guest with them. And I think at first they were reluctant, they said that they don't like to have guests, but then the BBC guy sent them some of my music and they said, okay, you can play one tune.
Oh.
So they were rehearsing from the morning to the late afternoon, and my slot to rehearse was about like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they had to turn up. So I was like, yeah, whatever. So I turned up at 10 in the morning and just sat down.
Wow.
And I was like, so, I'm here. They're like, okay, cool, you can play this. So I rehearsed all day, like, okay, since you know the set, come and do the gig in the evening. So then I went and did the gig, and then we did the session the next day, and they said, well, whenever we're around in the same space, you can come up on stage with us, because you're like a part of the band now. You know?
Yay!
And yeah, they said, you know, like, you don't pick the members, the creator picks the members, and if you're in, you're in. So it's been an ongoing relationship for the last 3 years, where whenever we're in the same space, whenever they're in England, I'm around. Or if we're on the same festival with my other band, then I'll get up and guess with them. And it's been such an inspiring relationship just to be in that situation of, I guess, for one, Marcel Annan, like, one of the first things that he kept on telling me was that I'm thinking too much.
Yeah.
You know, so I was thinking about what I was doing, thinking if I'm doing the right thing at the right point. And I can see my mind working. I can see that I was doing that. And
right.
I couldn't switch it off. And Ross is getting upset with me. He's like, look, man, you need to just play. You know, you get on the stage, you play.
Right.
Play the saxophone. Stop thinking about what you're doing, just play.
Uh-huh.
And we'll tell you if you should not be doing something. But until we do that, you play the saxophone. And that was a lesson in itself. And it's something that I thought about a lot. You play first.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of reasonings in terms of, like, how the process should go. Like, do you think first? Do you understand what you're going to do from a thought perspective, from a perspective of knowing? Or do you approach what you're doing from a perspective of unknowing and discovery?
Wow. What
I
if
want
you...
the latter.
Oh, okay.
There's an element of, like, chaos in the whole structure of the band.
Yes.
But it's like, I see it like a family, like,
yes.
If you get that image of a big family around a dinner table and they're like little units that have had long, like, really good histories together, there's tension, there's maybe little kind of like ruptures in between certain people, the people that are making up, the people that really gel together, all of these things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, it's still a family. It's
right.
Still one unit.
Right.
And for me, that's what the orchestra is. It's one unit. And it's not something that's trying to be one vision. It is actually one unit. So within that unit, it means that you can have many, many different voices. They've got the same message. So they can then be their own individual self.
You mentioned one of the drummers, Sebastian Rockford.
Yeah.
He is no longer with the group. But I also noticed he was wearing a producer's hat as well.
Yeah.
Does his departure mean anything for Sons of Kemet?
It meant that I worked a lot more closely with the producer for this next album
yeah.
that we've made. We worked with the same producer that I worked with. And we did the same process of, like, I just sat in there with him every day. And we just did the mixing and the producing together. I don't have a lot of technical know-how, but I know what I want. So I'll just describe it to him as best as I can. And then we just have a process where the vision comes out however it needs to.
Excellent. What do you see yourself doing after the Winter Jazz Fest in January?
After the Winter Jazz Fest, it's going to be madness because then the Sons of Kemet album comes out. And it's coming out with quite a prominent US label. We're just sorting out the very last details.
Okay.
So that's going to be basically all kicking off in March.
Okay.
And life will no longer be the same. Hopefully.
Excellent. Well, Shabaka Hutchings, thank you so much for... Oh, one more thing before we go. Social media.
Yeah.
Everybody, they may not want to, but they have to have some sort of interaction with social media. Are you
yeah.
responsible for your own interaction, or is somebody else doing it for you?
No, I do everything.
Okay.
I love it.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, I've got a whole thing about it. I've been on social media for ages. Like, before
uh-huh.
it was cool... for artists to be on social media,
right.
I was just putting up pictures and videos because I am a narcissist. I'm not one of these narcissists that's a kind of nasty narcissist where they're ashamed of what it means and it just comes out in really, like, insidious ways. I'm a narcissist in that I really enjoy the thing that I do.
Yes.
And I want other people to see it. And because I accept it, I don't want to push it in people's face. So it's like understanding what that impulse is and then managing it so that you're not, you're not a obnoxious narcissist.
Mm.
You know, because that's the problem. It's not being something, it's just being insensitive or obnoxious with it Also, one of the things that I had been thinking about for many years is the fact of, like, what stands up in the face of history, and it's the stuff that's documented.
Yes.
And for me, social media is, I treat it like an online archive.
Yes.
Like a diary of this period in my life where things are happening. So I can go back in 3 years' time or 4 or 5 years' time and go, this was a period of me touring. And there's little videos or little reviews or whatever, pictures, and I can go back and see it. Anyone can see it.
Excellent.
And that's what I'd like for the people that I was really into when I was a teenager, for instance. You know, I wanted to find out lots of information on, say, Seamus Blake or Myron Warden or people like that. And
right.
I couldn't find anything.
Right.
You know, I wish that they had an online archive of what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So I treat it like that. I'll try to post as much as possible. Not like overly much, but, you know, just as I'm doing stuff every day. And I'll try to have something that leaves a print of what I've been doing. Professionally, obviously. I don't post what I've been eating. You know, like if I've seen a cute dog.
Right. Of course. Oh, great. All right. Well, thank you so much, Shabaka Hutchings, for spending all this time with us and telling us about your projects. And we look forward to seeing you during the Winter Jazz Fest.
Great. I see them. Bye.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. We'd like to thank our guest for this evening, Shabaka Hutchings. And what you're listening to right now in the background is Light Years. That's from The Comet Is Coming. The release is Channel the Spirits. This is a special edition version that was released earlier this year on the Leaf label. Shabaka Hutchings, a.k.a. King Shabaka, on tenor saxophone. He's also a co-composer. Maxwell Hallett, a.k.a. Betamax Killer, on drums. Dan Levers, a.k.a. Danalog the Conqueror, on keyboards. Before that, we heard Mulatu Stake and the Heliocentrics from a release titled Inspiration Information 3. That's a 2009 Strut label release. There are several musicians on here, but the key ones, Mulatu Stake, is on Wurlitzer electric piano, and it includes Shabaka Hutchings, our guest for this evening, on tenor saxophone. Before that, you heard Slamming. This is a previously unreleased selection featured on The Comet Is Coming's special edition Channel the Spirits release on Leaf Label 2017. Before that, we heard Afrofuturism from Sons of Kemet from Lest We Forget What We Came Here to Do, 2015 Naim Jazz release. Shabaka Hutchings on tenor saxophone, bass clarinet. He's also the composer. Theon Cross on tuba. Sebastian Seb Rockford on drums. He was also the producer. And Tom Skinner also on drums. Before that, we heard The Long Night of Octavia E. Butler, and In Memory of Samir Awad, also from The Sons of Kemet's Lest We Forget What We Came Here to Do. Many thanks to Shabaka Hutchings for making himself available. I really appreciate his generosity of time and just making himself available. I am so grateful. And I will be grateful to you for calling 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or going to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. We really do need your financial support, and I didn't spend as much time as I should have to ask you, because you know we need. You know, when we come to you, we're not just playing around. We do need your assistance. Your assistance allows us to continue to provide the program, such as what you've listened to and what you hear throughout WBAI. Scheduled to come on next is La Nueva Alternativa, and we are scheduled to return on December 24th, Christmas Eve. We will continue our Winter Jazz Fest preview programming. You need to call 516-620-3602 or go to give2wbai.org. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.